Well, this morning we talked about what is codependence, and we talked about this tree that I drew up here. And you remember up in the branches and the leaves, there was addiction. And down here was our unresolved trauma at the root of all of our issues. And we also talked about how that codependence then is a trunk, the adult response to unresolved trauma or unmet needs is codependence. And it's not a child's response. I love that Donna made that point today, is that you can't be codependent if you're a kid because you're just acting your age all the time, right? But when you're 35 years old and you're acting like a 12-year-old, then you got a problem. So, but there is an addiction that you don't have to get into chemical dependency or even many process addictions. You can even avoid all of those and still be suffering from love addiction. And when I talk about love addiction and love avoidance, what we're talking about is really avoidance. What we're really talking about is untreated codependence and how it works out in your most intimate relationships. And so that's what we're going to talk about for some time this afternoon. And then Elizabeth's going to come in with me around 3:30, since we are the consummate poster couple for recovery from love addiction and love avoidance. And we always say, if we could recover from the hell that we were living in, we have this confidence, you can too. Really, I mean, it was that bad. So to understand love addiction and love avoidance, we have to remind ourselves of the, I don't mean to be rude, but I'm chewing a lozenge to keep my voice going, so. We have to remind ourselves of the bonding situation, that parents teach us how to bond. Parents teach us how to have relationships with other people. They do that by how they have relationships with each other. They do that how they have relationships with ourselves as kids. And in a healthy parenting relationship, it looks like this. With the dependent child and all the energy flowing towards the dependent child in the relationship. In other words, the parent doesn't need anything from the child. All the need is flowing this way. It's flowing towards the child, and the child is dependent upon the parent. The parent isn't dependent upon the child. Okay, and that's a healthy bonding situation. And this kid growing up, this is healthy. This kid growing up learns some things about his or herself in that wonderful bond that's happening. That child realizes that they can rely absolutely upon the parent. They know that their needs are going to be anticipated. Okay, it's the only real relationship where you can afford to anticipate a need. I'll talk about that in a few minutes. But this child learns some things about his or herself, and the worst one is that he or she is precious. That they are a precious creation, precious child of God, if you will. They have value, they have worth, because this big, powerful adult is taking care of me. And if I cry, they come and take care of me. If I'm hungry, they feed me, and they make sure I have these fun things called birthdays. And, you know, on the first birthday, we let our kids eat cake. Just eat it. Just go for it on their first birthday. It's the only time we did that. But it was all over the... And we let them do things like that. And we also helped them when they were hurting. They could bring their troubles to us. And so they learned that they were precious. They had this inherent value. We taught them that. We didn't give it to them. Somebody greater than us gave that to them. But we are affirming it. We are simply saying, this is who you are. Okay? So the child knows he's precious... He or she's precious, that there's give and take in relationships. Child doesn't get to play with all the toys all the time. They have to learn how to say hear no and say no. They can have this part of the toy box, and the other sibling has to have the other part of the toy box. It's not all about them all the time. And they also learn that they're worth self-care. They learn to take care of themselves. A child has a natural propensity to want to do that anyway. I can do it, mommy. Let me do it. They have a natural desire to be independent from you. At the same time, they have the natural desire to bond with you. It's really quite a paradox. Sadly, that's not a big percentage of our society. What we have more commonly is these two things. One is abandonment. And that is where all the energy from the parent is flowing away from the child. Now, I say all. Perhaps it's the majority, most of the time. It's bad enough, right? It's bad enough to create a sense in the child that he or she is lonely. He and she is missing something. And so all this energy is flowing away from the dependent child. The child still has all those needs that we talked about this morning, but they're not being met. They may be getting the food, shelter, and clothing and to keep them alive. It's like I told my mother, you know, thank you for not letting me be eaten by wild animals. That's about the best Mother's Day card I could put together one year. It was about, and be honest, right? I didn't know how to say anything much more than that, you know? And so this kid's not getting eaten by wild animals, but pretty much everything else is they're losing out on. All the attention. My dad, bless his heart, is a recovering addict himself, and my mother was all caught up in taking care of him all the time, and so all the energy was flowing towards my dad, and eventually my sisters and I, all of our energy was flowing towards dad as well. So it was about dad all the time. I remember as an 8-year-old having my dad tell me, my mother tell me, Ricky, she called me Ricky, Ricky, if you really want to help me, you won't want or need anything from me. You tell an 8-year-old that, you know, and as an 8-year-old kid, you go, what? Well, okay, I assumed that was my role then. My job was to not want or need anything. So I didn't even learn to brush my teeth till I was in 7th grade. And the only reason I did is because some friends of mine told me, hey, don't you brush your teeth? No. Yeah. Well, I might try it out, you know. I might check it out, Rick. So this child grows up learning some things too. We talked about that this morning, that he or she is worthless, that they deserve to be abandoned, that people are going to leave them. That's a huge point, that I can't trust people to stick around. I can't trust people to mean what they say. My mom says she loves me and she shows me she doesn't. If you want to make a kid crazy, tell a child one thing and do another. That'll make you crazy. Deserve to be abandoned. And at the same time, this child says, well, if I don't connect, however, I'm going to die. And this is the aching loneliness that we codependents know. This is the stuff that when we go to bed at night, put our head on our pillow, and we feel alone, and that just saturates our soul. Or the loneliness that we feel when we're in a crowd of 1,000 people or 100 people, and we still feel isolated. We don't know how to connect. There's one other less common, but very common approach to parenting in our society, and that is of enmeshment. And that is when all the energy from the child, all the energy is flowing from the child, as nutty as that sounds, to the parent. And this is where the parent is the needy one in the relationship. And these are the situations where maybe it's a single parent, and or the other parent is an addict, or there's the addiction going on in the home, or they're just immature themselves. They never grew up, and so little Johnny or Mary becomes mommy or daddy's little big person. You know, I'm so glad that I can talk to you, Johnny. I just can't talk to your dad anymore. He's always drinking. And I just, you know, you're just my hero. You're just the man in the house now, not your dad. Or the father's saying, you know, your mother, she's just a drag. You know, I don't know. Let's go for a drive in the car. That's what my dad did. Let's go for a ride. So I just drive, sit in their car, and he'd be talking. And he'd sit there and complain about my mother all the time. And so he was taking me into his confidence, though. And then he started telling me dirty jokes and things as escapades with women. But don't tell your mom. Don't tell your mom. Yeah, don't tell her I said that, okay? You know. Or he'd tell me any other things. Or mom would tell me, Rick, I had to start a savings account because your dad just spends all the money all the time. But don't tell your dad I have this savings account. So I had all this responsibility going on. I was responsible for my dad's feelings all the time, just like the rest of the family. So I was in mess with my dad. I was emotionally abandoned by my mother. So I was learning this at the same time. I was learning that I have a duty or a job to caretake. That's my job. And it is my duty to do so. However, what I learned about relationships in that is that for me to connect or to be in relationship is to die. Because a child growing up in an enmeshed situation really has like a spiritual death because they don't get to be them. Their job is to take care of these adults, or at least this adult in the home. So this is a child that can't do extracurricular activities at school because they got to be able to come home and take care and clean the house. It's because mom's sick again. Or they got to come home and do something so dad doesn't get drunk. And so their friends say, let's go to the movies. And say, I'm sorry, I can't. I got to get home. I got to go home. So their first responsibility is not to themselves or to their life, because they don't have a life. Their first responsibility is to taking care of the needy parent. And there's these special relationships. I see this on YouTube all the time. Not YouTube, but Facebook from time to time. You know, click here if you absolutely think your son is the very best friend in the whole world and you're never going to have anybody else as good a friend as he is. You know, I won't go, You know, I think we call that enmeshment. You're killing your son. And all the time there's unicorns and rainbows and flowers. And so these kids... We can take care of the healthy situation for now. I'll move that on. But these kids grow up learning that that's how to relate. Sometimes you can be both. I was both. I was in this state, and I was in this state. I was this way with my mother, and I was this way with my dad. So let's give this couple a name. Let's see. We'll make... her name? Peggy? Peggy, okay, we're good. No offense to any Peggy's in here. Okay. I taught this at a treatment center recently. They gave this one Robin and Batman. Okay, here's Peggy. Now she's grown up. Now she's an adult, and mom and dad have kicked her out or whatever. Now she's on her own. And she's still got all these unmet needs. And the story that she's believed about herself is that she's worthless, that people are going to leave her, she deserves to be abandoned, but she has this aching need to connect with somebody soon, or I'm going to die. But I feel like I'm worthless, so I don't know what to do. This guy over here, and what do we call him? I'm sorry?
Herman.
Okay. No offense to the Hermans in the room. He's grown up too. Now they're both adults. The cortex is fully developed. And there they are. And so you realize the situation now. Remember, for her to connect is to die. I have to connect or I'm going to die. And for him... If I connect, I'm going to die. I'm going to be consumed. I'm just going to be overwhelmed. Okay. So they're in a room with 100 people at a party, and there's 98 people there who are normal, healthy, been in recovery for a long time, which would be a miracle in itself, right? But the other miracle is that these two find each other. She looks across the room and sees him, and he sees her. And suddenly the music starts. And it's just like in the movies where the couple are just slow motion running towards each other. You know? And suddenly he sees her from across the room. He says, oh, look it. She's by the punch bowl by herself. I mean, she's kind of pretty. She looks kind of sad, though. And immediately, he's drawn to her. So she looks across the room, sees him. But she sees him through a haze of fantasy. Now, this is a very important point. She doesn't see a flesh and blood human being. She sees a God. Somebody, and she starts immediately fantasizing about this guy. You know, oh, look at him. He's 6'2". He probably played football. He probably loves all the music that I love. And she's got this whole fantasy going. Within 30 seconds, she's got this whole life together, made up for them. But it's not obviously based in reality, right? It's a fantasy. And this is where the addiction occurs. She's not addicted to him. She's addicted to what? The fantasy. Now that is huge. My recovery began from love addiction when I realized that I was addicted to a fantasy. And it was a child's fantasy. And it's just okay for children to fantasize. That's what they do. That's how their imaginations develop. But when you're 35 or 50 years old and you're still running around with these kind of fantasies about what a relationship would look like, you got problems. Okay, she also has no boundaries. Zero boundaries. I don't even know how to draw no boundaries. So we'll just put a zero there. No boundaries. She's going into the relationship from a place of one down. She feels less than in relationships. She feels like everybody's better than she is. She really doesn't deserve a good guy. But she's really attracted to this guy. And she's also driven in relationships by fear. And what would that fear be? Yeah, she's going to be alone the rest of her life. Nobody's ever going to love her like she needs to be loved. Well, Herman over here, he doesn't have any relationship, any boundaries either. What he has is a wall. And he sees Peggy, and he doesn't see a flesh and blood human being either. What he sees is potential. He sees a construction project. He's thinking, you know, I bet I could help her. Now, he would never use psychobabble. He would never say, I think I could fix her. You know, I think I could make up for her emotional losses. He just knows he feels strangely drawn to her, and she looks pretty needy. So he's feeling, yeah, I could do something. Because I tell you, what he's driven by in relationships is guilt. Because remember what his job was in the family? What was it? Take care of the parent, to fix the parent. And what didn't happen? The parent didn't get fixed, right? So you poured all your life's energy as a kid growing trying to fix his parent, and the parent's as sick as ever. I can attest to that. I tried for a long time to fix my dad, and he allowed me to, way into adulthood. And I had a certain guilt that I just didn't quite get the job done. I realize that today. So he's being motivated in this relationship by guilt. But Herman's going into a relationship one up. He's feeling pretty good about himself. You know, after all, if you're a kid and you can take care of an adult, you got to be special, right? You got to be pretty cool. That's why, who wants to play games with all those other kids out in the playground? You're home taking care of serious business. You're here taking care of your mother's depression. Who needs a baseball game? They're immature. I'm mature. So he has this whole thing going on about himself. Now, here's the other insane thing. She has an overriding fear of abandonment. But she has also an underlying fear of intimacy. He has an overriding fear of intimacy with an underlying fear of what? Abandonment. It's a marriage made in hell, isn't it? I mean, it's just you think these two would repulse each other. You think after her childhood, she would say, I'm looking for a man who's not going to leave me, who's going to be available to me, and I'm not going to be attracted to anybody else. But she's not. She's attracted to what's familiar, and so is he. And so they're attracted to each other. So they've entered this relationship, and for the first couple, 3 weeks, or the first couple months, it's great. The sex is great. There's all this intensity. There's all this stuff going on. She's around with her girlfriends going, I just met the most wonderful man. He just loves me. He sends me flowers all the time. He fixed my car. And he did all these things, and he just tells me how much he loves me, and, oh, it's just, it's going to be wonderful. I think we're going to go to Hawaii in November. And it's just, oh. And he's at the bar going, yeah, I met this chick. She's pretty. You know, she's a little needy. But it's okay. I can work with that. You know, she's, you know, because she's pretty good looking, and, you know, and she kind of reminds me of my mom in a way, you know, but, you know, that's kind of. And that brings up this point. These two feel like they've known each other forever. And why is that? Because they have, right, yeah. They know each other really, really well. And there's a reason why people, I remember a woman saying that to me. You know, I feel like I've known you forever, Rick. So if somebody ever says that to you on the first date, run. Yeah. And so they have all this, I have all this activity going on in here. All this, you know, it looks like a really great romance happening. But the demand, like any addiction, doesn't get met. Okay? You give an alcoholic a beer, guess what he's going to want? More. Because we're addicted to more. That's what we're addicted to. And so the more attention she receives from Herman, the more she what? Wants. And so I talked to a fellow not long ago who said, you know, I asked my girlfriend to text me 8 times a day and tell me she loved me. And he really thought that was a reasonable request. He couldn't understand why she was resisting that. And so she's putting out all this energy, and it starts bouncing off his wall. Because there's no real relationship happening here. And she starts sensing that. Something's not right. He's been sending me flowers 3 times a week for a long time now, and I only got it 1 time this week. Or I called him, he didn't call me right back. He didn't call me until the next day. Something's not right. And she's starting to get a little freaky because her drug of choice is starting to get a little scarce. Because she's wanting more, and it's getting more scarce. So she's starting to go into a literal state of withdrawal. Just like heroin. She's starting to go into a literal state of withdrawal. And because of all the demands, he's starting to back away. But this is a relationship these two have. You know, a bond would look like this, right? Two people just bond. Enmeshment looks like this. Isolation looks like this. And a healthy bond looks like this. But this is a relationship that love addict and love avoidant have. This here, the space in between them. There's really no bonding because they don't know how to do that. So one starts moving towards the other and she backs away. The other one starts moving and the other one backs away. And so she's saying all the time, I want more relationship, I want more relationship. Well, if he starts giving it to her, guess what she does? She starts backing away. And that really confuses him. So then he backs away and she goes, oh no. And she starts moving towards him. And so you have all this activity going, but there's no relationship happening. So she goes into withdrawal. He goes back to the bar. And the guys say, boy, you hear about Peggy? She's having a really rough time. Yeah. Did you break up with her? Well, I just said I didn't want to see her so much anymore, that maybe we should see other people. Oh, man. Yeah, she hasn't been at work in 2 weeks. She's probably going to get fired. Somebody saw her the other day. She hasn't washed her hair for a week. She's eating junk food all night. She's really in a rotten spot. And guess what happens to Herman? Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Here I come to save the day. Remember the Andy Kaufman thing? And so he feels that not because he's heroic, only because he feels guilt. So he calls her and says, hey, how you doing? And she goes, I'm fine. And wipes all the junk food up. I'm fine. Everything's great. And her brain's lighting up again. And she's saying, he loves me. And then the whole cycle starts all over again. And these are serious issues, because what can happen is I gave you the pleasant version. Let's see if I can get up here. By the way, any of these slides, we're going to arrange to get them to you if you want them. So, yeah, we can email them to you. So the dance has begun. As you can see, I just explained that to you. This is a great case of love addiction, love avoidance. She was a love addict, and he was what? Yeah, yeah. He got seduced. They seduced each other, got in this relationship, and it all started out so well. But this is a love addiction and love avoidance is a leading cause of domestic violence in a home, even in a marriage. Sometimes, especially in a marriage. So there's no real bond possible. The love addict is addicted to the fantasy, not a real person, moves away if truly cared for in a healthy manner. And the love addict will actually sabotage a relationship to create abandonment. If that love addict falls into a relationship accidentally that's healthy, stumbles accidentally into a relationship with a healthy person, he or she will find a way to sabotage it because it's unfamiliar. It doesn't fit. I wasn't interested in healthy women when I was single. I thought I was. If somebody said, "Are you interested in sick women?" I said, no, you kidding. You know? But we'll talk about that in a minute, won't we, honey? So the fantasy leaves him unavailable for authentic relationship. And this is what I did to Elizabeth for years in our marriage. I had such a high standard for what our marriage should be and what our relationship should be. She could not live up to it. Every time she tried to move up to it, I'd raise the arm bar. And she was under this constant, who can compete with Ms. Perfect? Because I'm not looking for an authentic human being. I'm looking for perfection. I'm looking for somebody who's going to love me perfectly, never say anything mean to me, just be with me, give me meaning and purpose in life. And this is all becomes an addiction also because it's a spiritual block. I virtually make Elizabeth, in this scenario, my higher power. She's the one who gives me meaning in life. She completes me. It's like Tom Cruise. I mean, it's really sad. And I would never have admitted it. I have a degree in theology. I've done pastoral work. If somebody said, "You're making her your God," I said, "Oh, no, the creeds say this," or something. I'd have been very religious about it. But the fact is, the truth is, I was making her my higher power. My happiness depended upon her. And in my first marriage, I was the avoidant. And so I was playing higher power in her life. She didn't have a life except what I said we should do. Because after all, I was the final word, right? It was really bad. So the love avoidance is seductive and moves away from mutual relationships. Neglects relationship for extreme sports or high-risk behavior to feel alive. Because when a love avoidant is in a relationship, they feel dead. Actually, they feel dead most of the time inside anyway. Right? Because they never were able to be themselves growing up. They were never able to develop a sense of self. They played that role in the family instead of developing who they were. And so there's just this emptiness inside. And when they're in relationship, it's worse. And so a love avoidant will oftentimes get involved in extreme sports, extreme high-risk behaviors, just to get some adrenaline going. Love avoidants love to show up at the airport 2 minutes before the airplane leaves. You know, and they're getting a buzz out of it. Now, they won't admit it, but that kind of thing they do. Driven by compulsion to fix someone and resolve the childhood guilt. So what do we do? You know, how do you break this cycle? Yeah. Same thing we talked about this morning. You have to find that loving, healthy adult in your life, and it has to be you. You have to quit trying to be that to somebody else, and you have to quit trying to ask somebody else to be that to you. So to break the cycle, like any addiction, you have to stop the behavior, right? You have to put down the bottle. You have to step away from the relationship. Well, Elizabeth and I, of course, were married. And so what was that? What were we going to do? You know, separate? You know, how do we deal with that? So we realized that it had to break someplace. And so it was this kind of a cold turkey. I just had to recognize, first of all, that I was not addicted. Because Donna had talked to me about this for months on end. But the day my recovery began is when I realized I was addicted to a fantasy. And I began to attach to some sorrow for what I'd put her through for 12 years. I began to see what I had done to her. And I began to recognize that I had done that to every relationship I had been in. And that I also began to recognize that I could be driving down any street in Seattle, be driving by bus stop, glance over, see a perfectly decent human being, a female, standing there, drive by, and this fantasy would begin in my head about what it would be like to be with her. And I don't mean it's some sexual fantasy necessarily. Sometimes it's just about, wow, I bet that would just be great. We could just be such great friends, and we could skip down the beaches of Hawaii, and all this stuff would start going on in my brain.
Just from seeing
them. I drive by him on the bus stop. He's like, hey. And all this fantasy starts going. This person could be an axe murderer for all I know. And probably is, if that's part of my brain's attracted to him. And so there's constant disappointment, constant letdown. Love addict gets to a relationship with a god or a goddess, and you find out they belch at dinner, and you go, oh, God. A goddess wouldn't do that, you know. Ugh, you know. Or they have bad breath or something, you know. Well, this is not a goddess. This is a human being. Yeah. So what would self-care look like for old Peggy here? Lots of therapy, yeah. What would she remember, she can't hear no. That's the other aspect of this relationship. She can't hear no. Peggy can't hear no. And good old Herman can't say no. That's another thing, made in hell. Okay? So she keeps demanding, and he keeps saying, okay, or he just stops returning her calls. He puts up this wall because he really doesn't want to know her. Avoidants don't want to have real relationships with you. It's all news, sports, and weather all the time. You start talking about feelings, they'll go, whoa. You pick up the ticket tonight. I'm going home. You pick up the check. Check, please. So there's this no problem going on between them. So maybe where she could start self-care is beginning to accept the fact that she could say no. She could hear no, I should say, and it'd be okay. She would be okay. She needs some kind of a support group. She needs some kind of a 12-step program. She needs a good therapist. She needs some kind of a community around her that can affirm her worth while she's learning to affirm it in herself. And so when a man says, you know, I can't see you four times this week, she can say, okay, I'll be all right. Will you call me next week? First time, one of the first days Elizabeth had was on a Tuesday night, and I said, well, when can I see you next? She said, how about Saturday? I said, how about tomorrow? She said, well, no. So I finally negotiated her down to Thursday, and then I just kind of paced back and forth till Thursday, you know. So, but I had to learn to say here no, and know that I was going to be okay. I had to learn that I could take care of myself outside a relationship, that I could depend on me, even if I couldn't depend on this other person. What would self-care look like for old Herman? Say no. Yeah, and let it be a complete sentence. I'm sorry, I can't see you four times this week. I'm working. I haven't got anything done at the office since I met you. And of course, moderation and boundaries and reality and the spirituality is a huge part, because both of them need this moderation in the relationship. Both of them need to know how to say no and set boundaries with each other, not walls. Because he takes down his wall and gets willing to talk about something other than news, sports, and weather. He gets more of a porous boundary, and she actually has a boundary. So the relationship has some hope. And then she has to learn that she's addicted to a fantasy, just like I did. That was a huge point. I remember Donna asked you, when was your turning point? And I said, when I realized I was addicted to a fantasy. And again, an attachment to sorrow that I had for how I treated her all that time. And then start talking about feelings between each other. Start being able to communicate with boundaries. We'll talk about that in a moment. And then spirituality. Both of you have to establish some level of a relationship with a power greater than yourself, whom I choose to call God. Because if I'm depending upon my higher power, I'm not as dependent upon somebody else. Codependence, love addiction, love avoidance is all about this insanity where we've lost the sense that there's any God anywhere except for in you. or in me. That we don't see each other as imperfect flesh and blood human beings. We put God-like demands on each other. Or we have God-like expectations of ourselves. And it just kills our relationships with ourselves and with each other. Okay. This is going to work. So family of origin work, letting go of fantasy, accepting self and others as real, imperfect, but beautiful people, celebrating no. No is a huge piece. Just a sec. Celebrating no as opposed to fearing no. So today when Elizabeth says no, I'm learning to celebrate that because she's taking care of herself. And I want her to take care of herself, right?
Right.
Yeah, and I've learned to do that. I didn't always like it, like she said in the last session. No, what's that mean? And then I said this morning about the I thou. So come on up, honey. We can answer a few questions and see where we go from here with this.
Yeah.
That was a lot of information really quick. It's kind of the fire hose approach. But as I said, we'll be happy to answer your questions candidly. And we have one over here.
So I recognize Peggy and Herman.
Oh.
So what does the child of Peggy and Herman look like? Do they possess all of the qualities?
It's a very lonely child.
Can you repeat the question?
What does the child of a love addict, love avoidant look like? Very lonely child. Probably a developing addict themselves. Because there's so much drama going on in the relationship between mom and dad that there's no real time or energy left over for the kids. That happened in my first marriage. There was so much drama. My first wife, which I believe is deceased now, she ran off and was paranoid, schizophrenic. I didn't know that. She was having hallucinations, and I was all caught up trying to care for her. There was so much drama going on all the time that my three kids just really didn't get a whole lot of me at all. It's a very lonely child. Yeah. Any other questions? Yeah, I was avoidant, yeah.
How did that happen?
Well, because I grew up, it depends on the relationship I'm in. So the question is, how is it that I was switching from a love addict to love avoidant, right? So it depends on the relationship. Now, I don't intend to have any more relationships, obviously. But my point is, in my first marriage, I met this woman who was incredibly needy, and I switched right into my avoidant role and played out that relationship for 20 years of nightmare. And so when I met Elizabeth, she was a little stronger than I was. She had some things going on that I didn't. I went down and started playing the addict role. And it's just, yeah. So I didn't have a lot of hope, did I? I mean, I was a troubled boy. I think so, don't you think? Oh, is it possible to switch in between, in one, in within the relationship,
yes,
back and forth roles?
Yes.
Yeah, you want to address that, or you want me to? Step in here, honey.
No, go.
Yeah. Yeah, well, yeah, because remember, it's an over. I have an overriding fear of abandonment and an underlying fear of intimacy. And so when she starts moving towards me, I get switched back into almost more an avoidant role. And if she starts pursuing me, that's why it's really difficult for one person to get well and the other one not, because it just triggers all the stuff in the other person. How do you have a relationship with a person who has an overriding fear of abandonment and an underlying fear of intimacy, and vice versa on the other side? I mean, it's like this all the time. So. Yes, in fact, I meant to make that point. Is the intimacy, they're afraid of it because they really don't know what it is, and that's exactly right. We are attracted to what is familiar. And what is the root word of familiar?
Family.
Family, yes, good answer, yeah. Yeah, so, and there's this thing called xenophobia, too, which is the fear of the unfamiliar or fear of the strange, and that's kind of in our DNA. It's probably a good thing. It keeps us from, you know, hooking up with anybody. But xenophobia just means I'm afraid of the unfamiliar. That's why it was really, and Elizabeth would agree, I believe. Wouldn't you agree that we were not attracted to healthy people when we met each other?
Clearly not.
Yes, yeah. Yeah. The first night we were together, we got drunk. And then I showed up at my roommate with my apartment at 4 o'clock in the morning wearing one of her T-shirts because I'd spilled wine a little bit. It was not, and I'm in love.
Doesn't that sound like a great date?
Yeah.
Sounds
familiar.
Yeah.
Right.
I have a quick question. I'm probably the love addict, not as much.
Okay.
However, like you had said that you tend to fantasize, which obviously that's me as well. But how do you get, like, I know you can break the cycle by doing that and get less, you know, do things less and do those 5 steps that you do, you know, 5 steps for recovery or whatever. But how do you, like, stop yourself from thinking?
The question is, how does a love addict stop themselves from thinking? Yeah. Huh?
Fantasizing.
And what I had to do, I just had to recognize it was a fantasy. Nobody could live up to that expectation. So I just had to get honest with myself. Yeah, so I recognize today when I drive by a bus stop and I start thinking, boy, that's a lovely woman. I wonder about what her husband, I mean, but they have this lovely thing going on or whatever. I recognize that's my addiction stop. It's just like if I walked through a grocery store and I went through the liquor aisle. You can do that at Toys R Us now, you know that? I mean, that's kind of, no, I'm just kidding. Seems like it. Everywhere you go now is liquor. And so when I walk through a liquor aisle, I have to be aware of the fact that I'm an alcoholic. And I might get thirsty for a moment or I might have some trigger. I'm not going to do anything about it. Yeah. So, yeah. Well, it depends on how long you entertain it.
As we've been told, I'm not responsible for my first thought because that's where the addiction comes in. I'm responsible for the next one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, if I start entertaining that fantasy, I'm in trouble.
As Donna says, you're not responsible for the first thought, so enjoy the show.
Yeah. And sometimes that's what I do. I just, it's like a parade that goes by. Huh.
Wow, isn't that interesting? I just had that thought. Huh.
And I feel grief. Nowadays, when I start doing a fantasy, I just feel grief. I just think, oh my gosh, Rick, I'm so sorry. Huh?
For the first thought, but I'm responsible for the next one.
Yeah. 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 Damon?
Right. Yeah, the comment here was the same thing about feelings. I'm not responsible for my initial triggered feeling, but I'm responsible for what I do next about it. Yeah. Good.
How did it make you feel when you just couldn't live up to my fantasy?
How did it make me feel?
Yeah. What was your life like? What was life like for you?
It was hell.
Yeah.
It was living hell because I love this man and I've always loved this man, and it was demoralizing to try to live up to that fantasy. And when I would get pretty close, the bar would be raised, or I'd find out there's a whole new category of things that I wasn't doing right. And the demoralization is just, I mean, there's a point where you just say, forget about it.
Yeah.
I don't even want to bother trying anymore. I don't care. And that's hard. I mean, that's that point when the relationship is about dead.
And what I would do is I would go to despair, utter despair. I'm never going to be loved. I would just be depressing.
And interesting how he set himself up for it, right?
Yeah, I set myself up for it. And I just believed that if I'd been with anybody else, life would be wonderful. See, I'm not proud of that. I'm just saying that's an addict's thinking. Yeah, orange shirt. Yeah, you can be a love. Well, your first love addiction was to your parent. That's, by the way, a very good point. Your first love addiction, your first love avoidance was to a parent. I don't return my dad's calls hardly ever. Yeah.
So I understand this because I've lived it, and I get the thing about you walk into a room. That's very nebulous. I mean, are there some behaviors that I, as the addict, are there some behaviors that I can look for in somebody that, you know, pull me in, this is an avoidant person?
Well, they're usually very seductive.
Yeah.
They're very charming. I can just charm the socks off when I'm an avoidant.
And remember that the addict and the avoidant are attracted to each other. So if it's the person that is electricity across the room immediately, probably not a good idea to pursue that.
Yeah. And there's no such thing as love
at
first sight.
Yeah.
Nightmares at first sight. My worst fear is not finding perfect love. Okay, so.
At this point, and then it becomes harder and harder for Elizabeth. Why was the bar raised?
Well,
are you still testing to see if she's going to come through?
Well, she never could meet it anyway. So she would meet it, and it was not perfect. So I just raised the bar. She was not perfect. She would make her best attempt, and it wasn't perfect. So I just raised the bar that I knew would be perfect. And I wasn't even conscious I was doing this. And every time she would reject me or push away a little bit, I would go right into a child mode. I would go into this frightened little boy, this depressed little boy. And then I'd get angry. I could become an angry teenager. And that's when the fighting would start. And remember, in this love addiction, love avoidance, we're both trying to get our needs met. And in our minds as children, emotional children, only one of us can get our needs met. Either she can get her needs met or I can get my needs met. And so there's this power struggle going on all the time. Who's going to get their needs met?
And the difficult part when he was in that state was that what I finally realized, that he was inconsolable. I don't know if anybody else has tried the strategies of, I tried to talk to you, I tried to yell at you, I tried to cry, I tried to, you know, I've tried the whole menu and none of them work. And it's because that arm bar is, or the cheese moved, you know, the goal moved, you know.
Yeah.
The perfect, you know, prize moved.
Yeah. We only have time for a couple more.
You had love to come back to. How do you know you
even We didn't.
The question was, how do you know you had love to come back to in the first place?
I don't think we did we? I mean, we hoped.
You know, we're fortunate because we knew each other for about 5 years before we got into a relationship.
Yeah.
And so we had a friendship. And that friendship was because, you know, we had separate lives when we would get together. It was almost fantasy-like. It's like, I could spend a half an hour talking with them, and boy, I could make up what it would be like. So we both kind of had this fantasy, and when we got together, neither one of us were really living up to it very well, but kept falling back. And that's what kept, for me, it's what kept me here. It's like, I could leave him, I would be really sad, but God, he's my best friend, and I really like him. I mean, he's very likable.
There were times when we would say, you know what, let's just go be married. Really, remember that? You just say, we're not doing marriage very well. Let's just go back to our friendship. And we did. And I think that's part of what saved our relationship. Yeah. Okay, we only have one more. Yeah.
Can you share experience on making amends to adult children?
The question is, we're being asked, how do we make amends to adult children? Okay.
You know, all you can do is, as the ninth step in our literature talks about, you go and say, this is what happened. This, and you use I statements. This is what happened. This is what I think about it, and this is what I feel about it. Is there any way that I can make it up? I can make that right with you. And sometimes it won't. Ken told me a story about sitting with his son for 45 minutes and listening to his son saying, you are just a no good, blah, 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 blah. You know, and that may happen. And I had to listen today. So when my son says, or my kids say, Dad, this is what it was like growing up with you, and I want you to know, I have to sit and listen. You know, I don't take a lot of abuse or anything, but I do have to be willing to hear them. So, does that help? Yeah.
Okay. And just hearing them doesn't always fix it.
Yeah.
Do you know? That's the thing, is that I have to be willing to live in the tension of, it's not fixed yet. You know,
today,
there's no magic wand, there's no perfect thing to say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Today, our kids, I believe, want a marriage like ours. And what's that worth? You know, when our friends say, we like how you guys, you know, relate to each other, we like your marriage. When our kids come and stay up from out of town, and they say, boy, we just like being here with you guys. You know, so quiet around here, and you treat each other so respectful and so nice, and wow. You know, this is a couple who used to have a regularly scheduled police visit. And the first time the cops showed up at our house and it wasn't us, we were excited. I remember the cop coming there and say, George, it's not us tonight. Are you sure? Yeah, no, we're okay tonight.
Yeah, and I heard it down the street too.
Yeah.
I almost heard it myself.
Down the street too. I think there's something going on. And the first time we moved out of an apartment, I didn't have to replace windows or patch holes. It was such a celebration for me. We actually took care of the house. So one last question, then we had to be done.
So obviously you both were in recovery.
Yes.
The question is, what happens when only one person in a relationship is willing to get into recovery?
Well, I think what you can do is you can bring a lot of hope to that person eventually, if they're willing to be reasonable, okay? If they're willing to be reasonable and respect your recovery, and if you're willing to be reasonable and respect your own recovery and commit yourself to it, you could bring a lot of hope into that relationship. Because the best way we carry the message is by living it.
Well, that's how our recovery started, is that I was the alcoholic, so I had to go work a program. And it wasn't for almost a year before Rick was willing to say, gosh, maybe I need to do something about this too. Now, He wasn't drinking, but anybody who is alcoholic recognizes that you don't have to be drinking to be acting like a drunk.
Yeah. A drunken horse thief.
Yeah.
He's gotten sober.
Sober horse thief.
Okay, I think we need to end there. Ken and Mary coming up, so.
Yeah. Thank you.